Ladies and gentlemen, I think we can get started now. Thank you again for coming to this conference on the dawn of modern China, the 100th anniversary of China's 1911 revolution and the significance of the Republic of China. I'm pleased that so many people have come to listen to what I think is a really outstanding lineup of speakers. And we begin with a keynote address by Dr. Mary Baucus Rankin, who is one of the most prominent scholars on late 19th and early 20th century Chinese history. She has written a number of really great studies on that period, and she's working on understanding the 1911 revolution as it took place in different parts of China. So it is my great pleasure to welcome her today. Please join me in welcoming her.
Now, I might as well tell you I didn't quite finish this paper, but I do have a pretty good idea of what I was going to be saying toward the end. To start with, though, I'm going to start with the end of the Taiping and just do a very quick run that over that because it really is relevant to what came afterwards. But the end of that war gave way to this period of reconstruction that involved both officials and local social leaders, and for many survivors required a period of self-examination and reconstruction, in a way, to move beyond the trauma of the Taiping Wars. The establishment of Shunbao in 1872 was a landmark in the movement away from post-Taiping personal and local concerns towards new issues that soon arose. Local men who took responsibility for reconstruction then moved into continuing involvement in local affairs, such as permanent welfare organizations, positions in new academies that antedated the war, and Shunbao, which became a national newspaper by the early 1880s, played a very important part in fostering local activities and broadening public opinion. Among other things, it encouraged nationalism by disseminating news about major and minor foreign incursions. One of the first had been the Japanese brief expedition against Taiwan in retaliation for the deaths of some of their sailors from the Ryukyu Islands. The Chinese government thought it unnecessary to take a strong stand against claims of such an insignificant island, thus opening the way for further conflict. The next year, Shunbao presented the news of the British interpreter A.R. Margery in Yunnan. England did not take that lightly. The paper published news of all the British demands, negotiations, and naval troop movements. The next year, it informed its river readers about the dispute with Russia over control of the distant Ili region, including anchoring of Russian strips off Dinghai on the Zhejiang coast. This was also a minor matter, but the newspaper brought out the larger need for military preparations and coastal defense. Already uneasy about foreign threats, coastal elites were ready to defend the country, aware of the need for better military equipment, and at least some doubted that the bureaucracy would be able to modernize effectively. These were all minor incursions, but they were followed by the much more serious Sino-French War from 1883 to 85, and the Sino-Japanese War, of course, during 1894 and 95. The military aspects of the Sino-French War were less complex, French colonial expansion from Annam across the ill-defined Chinese border led to hostilities that by 1883 had become full-scale battles. And the French moved then their fleet north to attack Taiwan, blockaded Shanghai to keep Chinese ships on the Yung River rather than able to get out into the ocean before it moved south to destroy the Fuzhou naval yards. The Chinese government was sufficiently impressed to sign a peace treaty in 1885. Within Beijing, the war was complicated by furious attacks on Li Hongzhang and others by the so-called Qingyu group, who blamed Li in particular for China's defeats. Along the coast, elites led militias, contributed money, and ran the French blockade. Now, I have previously used the term participatory self-strengthening to distinguish views of Zhejiangese within the province from those of high officials within the government. These two groups might favor similar reforms, but with different implications. Official self-strengthening was a forerunner of state-building during the last Qing decade, which leaders did not encourage, in which leaders did not encourage widespread social initiative. Whereas participatory self-strengthening assumed social mobilization and cautiously raised the idea of giving administrative authority to local men and greater weight to public opinion. Elite reformers hoped for a less tyrannical and corrupt government. The public response to the Sino-Japanese War was in many respects similar to the social response to the Sino-French. Rumors, militias, individual and guild donations were part of the usual issues. Piracy increased, as did anti-missionary sentiment. Leaders in Beijing were again blamed for defeat, but this time questions were being asked about Zixi's role in governance. The short-lived Taiwanese Republic and the men who sought to prevent Japan's appropriation of the island lacked the numbers and military equipment to prevail. By the 1890s, there was little distinction between patriotism and nationalism. Jing Yanshan explicitly related patriotic mobilization and suggested a further threat. Chinese land was being cut up and the people's wealth was being used for indemnities. He wished that the people would contribute voluntary donations to aid in attaining voluntary supplies and call together voluntary troops to raise a voluntary army. All those voluntaries were in there in Shenbao. They would thereby save the country and requite the people. Now, during the short period after the end of the Sino-Japanese War and the beginning of the Hundred Days, both social elites and officials, including some like Zhang Jitong, who were very highly placed, undertook that this large a number of reformist activities, such as starting to establish schools, some new associations, newspaper reading societies, agricultural and anti-foot binding societies, chambers of commerce a little bit, cotton mills, sericultural institutes, silk filatures, debating societies, and more. New journals like Shubao, the Chinese Progress, appeared. And the large park known as Zhang's Garden became a popular meeting place for the new societies. Now, as you probably all know very well, during 1897, Hunan became another center of reformist activity with the encouragement of Governor Chen Baojun. Young enthusiasts like Tang Saizhang, Tan Sitong, pushed reform, and the retired Jiangsu Education Commissioner, Wang Xiangjian, advocated investment in commercial projects. He also encouraged students to read Shuobao, and more boldly suggested the establishment of the Academy of Current Affairs with Yang Chichao as Dean of Chinese Studies. After this modest beginning, the educational reform soon became more radical. By the end of 1897, the School of Current Affairs was in the hands of young scholars who had been invited to Changsha and who were also involved in publishing a new Hunan journal. By the end of the year, the writings were supporting the controversial Kang Youwei and had an anti-Manchu tone. Then, of course, the climax at that point was that in early in 1898, the South China study, Nan Shui Hui, was established along with the Xiangbao, which published many of the study society debates. And these included ideas of parliamentary government, people's rights, and people's parties, along with other things. Yang suggested that Hunan should prepare for independence. This seems to have meant gaining understanding how self-government worked, not separation from the Qing. And at this point, many new societies were appearing within the province that may have been indicative of intentions to create basics leading to creation of a provincial assembly. That didn't happen. Whatever the case, Zhang Zedong and more conservative gentry like Wang Xianqian had had enough. Chen Baochen was replaced as governor, the South China Study Society was closed, and the Hunan Journal ceased publication. The reformers responsible for the brief experiment left Hunan. So we get then to the 100 days, this 100 days of reform began in mid-June after Kang Youwei's interview with the Guangxi Emperor and ended on September 21st, 1898, when Zixi, with the support of Yuan Shikai and others, executed a coup. Regrettably, this coup had been precipitated by Tang Situn, who had called on Yuan Shikai and asked if he would join in removing Zixi from her continued supervision of Guangxu. Now, what Tang had in mind doing that, I just hesitate to say. Not surprisingly, Yuan told Zixi about Tang's plan. The emperor's political power was transferred back to her. A few changes had effectively been put into place before Zixi's coup, so very little had actually changed. However, Tan's rash move resulted in his immediate execution, along with five others who had seemingly not been involved at all. After that, extreme conservatives maneuvered to gain power within the court and ushered in about 2 years of extraordinary political instability. The announcement on January 24th, 1900, that Prince Tuan's son, Pu Jun, was to be the heir apparent immediately aroused fears that Guangxu was about to be deposed. The resulting protests were not limited to officials. Clear evidence that public opinion could now sometimes be expressed came from a telegram of 1,231 signatures collected by the Shanghai director of the Imperial Telegraph Administration, Qing Yuanshan, who was well known by elites in Jiangxi and Zhejiang. I really like that guy. Somewhat astonishingly, Qing's bold move ended further open discussion of that possibility. However, high-ranking Manchus were replacing Chinese officials. Gang Yi spent 6 months traveling around South China to demand payments from the governments, the provincial governments, and to to also look for hidden enemies. Liang Qichao and Kang Youwei had long fled to Japan. So I am going to skip over the Boxer Rebellion pretty much because I think you've all heard of that. So the next step after the Boxer Rebellion was pretty much taken care of was a revolutionary rising by Tang Saicheng, made in contact with central China, Gulao Hui. In the late winter of 1900, he established the Independent Society. That summer, he took another step by establishing a national assembly, Guohui, which held two meetings in Zhang's garden in Shanghai on July 26th and 30th. At this time also, a lot of people were holding meetings in Zhang's garden, some of them who knew Tang Saicheng and I think knew about his plans, but who were not particularly anxious to be part of them. Zhang Zetong urged Tang to flee, but he did not. Tang told Zhang Zetong that the revolt would, The revolt was definitely not a success. And this is why Zhang Zetong had urged Tang to flee. Tang told Zhang Zetong that the revolt was an alliance of followers of Kang Youwei. Tang then took measures to crush the conspiracy, had all 20 men who had been captured, executed, including Tang. Quite a number of these were students, some of whom Zhang Zetong knew, but he was determined to stamp out this kind of behavior. After that first set of executions, more rebels were caught and executed. It seems probable that the severity was because the rebels were part of a branch, Guohui, and also believed that there was an alliance between Kang Youwei's Bao Huanghui and Sun's revolutionaries, which there was not. By 1901, the worst of the danger had passed. Students were being sent to school in Japan. The Shanghai Educational Association and Patriotic School, with Tsai Yanpei as principal, and the Patriotic Girls' School attracted numerous students who devoted a good deal of time to military drill and calisthenics. And this radical complex also acquired the newspaper Subao that reached students in a number of cities. Then in the spring of 1903, a rumor was circulated that Guangxi governor Wang Zijun had asked for French troops to suppress a persistent secret society rebellion in Guangxi in return for mining and railway concessions. At the same time, there was news of Russian troops in Manchuria seeking to control mining interests in northern Manchuria. As a result, mass meetings attracting many students from Shanghai schools were held in the well-known Zhang's Garden. At this point, the growing radicalism of student circles caused a rift between the reformers and revolutionaries. Students began to distribute revolutionary literature along the Yangtze, and during the spring, Subo also became increasingly radicalized to the extent of advocating killing Manchus and publishing a review of Zhou Rong's famous revolutionary army. As is well known, the result of all the turmoil at schools was that officials closed the Patriotic School in June, arrested a few of those at the school, including Zhang Pingling and Zhou Rong. The Shanghai officials have been extremely reluctant to take action against this group, but eventually had to do so. In the end, Zhang was sentenced to 3 years in jail and Zhou to two. For, I think, unknown reasons still, Zhou died before being released. After that, revolutionaries continued to come to or pass through Shanghai, but it was not really as much as a revolutionary center. It was perhaps too close to Japan, where revolutionaries and other Chinese came for good military or other educations before seeking employment in the new schools and army brigades being established back home. Moreover, Shanghai was a very protean city, where such organizations as new schools, chambers of commerce, were beginning to play a part, or would soon be beginning to. Before long, it would become a center for major political movements, like the 1905 protests against the American government's decision to prevent Chinese from entering the United States, and the long-drawn-out fight over local control of construction of a railway between Shanghai and Hangzhou. There are also many cultural, artistic, and intellectual attractions for those less interested in politics. The literary Southern Society was one such example. It had been established in late 1909 and continued into the Republic. Some members were still politically active, some were not, and others came and went. What did happen was that many more students now went to school in Japan, either being sent by the government or on their own. And this meant they were often in close contact with one another and thereby might encourage each other to form groups to protest specific complaints. This happened in the spring of 1903 when students inflamed over the problems of Russian behavior in Manchuria undertook to form an anti-Russian volunteer corps. They bombarded Yanchukai in Beijing with telegrams expressing their intentions of stopping Russian encroachment. Meanwhile, students in Tokyo were drilling their small student army, but soon the Japanese Foreign Office made it clear that they would not be allowed to train militarily on Japanese soil. Finally, they sent two student representatives to see Yuan, who not surprisingly said he didn't want to see him. The final result was that students' views shifted further toward anti-Manchuism. At a July meeting, at a meeting in July, they remade their association into a secret radical organization. About half the members left. Those who remained maintained their secrecy and concentrated on overthrowing the Qing. There was one more major disagreement between students and Japanese educational officials who drew up a list of regulations to better control their behavior. After months of discussion, agreement was reached. The issue was settled amicably, though unfortunately not before Chen Tianhua drowned himself after reading derogatory articles about Chinese students in the Japanese press. After the Tongmenghui was established, students were given more encouragement to return to China and continue revolutionary work in schools, new armies, or various associations. More than in any other province, revolutionaries who looked to Sun Yat-sen launched a long series of uprisings, beginning in 1895 and ending with the Canton Revolt of April 17, 1911. Depending on how one counts, there were 12 attempts altogether. Sun Yat-sen was given credit for many, but was seldom involved in fighting, which frequently fell to Huang Xing. Some of these attempts were called off at the last minute. Others ended very quickly. The fighters still taking part were mostly members of secret societies, usually Guilaohui, or sometimes from the aggrieved local populace. The most important efforts were in the Pingyuli uprising on the Jiangxi-Hunan border. That was really the closest to a good attempt. Then there was Huang Xing's resultant unlikely attempt to end French incursions into China from Annan, which led him into a longer effort to gain followers in the countryside of western Guangxi, and a futile effort to win support of two army officers who never committed to the Tongmenghui. Finally, the much lauded New Army Mutiny April 27th might have had a significant outcome, but again there was confusion over the timing that gave the government troops a chance to gain control. 72 soldiers were captured and executed. The Guangdong revolutionaries were so weakened that they did not revolt again until, I think, the Second Revolution. Guangdong was, of course, not the only province to start building up its military, but most other provinces did so under governmental leadership. They were one part of a concerted reform movement after 1902 that arose both within the Qing government and in society to establish a hierarchy of new schools, chambers of commerce, self-government schools, to prepare people for local councils to be established near the end of the decade. Also agricultural societies and, of course, military schools to complete the listing. My purpose in this paper is to look at the new schools and chambers of one purpose in this paper is to look at the new schools and chambers of commerce that were encouraged by the Qing, but were often established and controlled by prestigious wealthy merchants and gentry. There are two books that are particularly useful for this topic, one by Xiaohong Xiaoplan, Education et politique en Chine, le rôle des élites du Jiangsu, 1905-1914, which was published at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. And then Zhong Pingchun has a book with a title of Associational Networks and Sociopolitical Change, or he may have changed that a little bit, which is being published by Stanford University Press and will probably be out in July. Xiaoplan argues that the Jiangsu education leaders, headed by Zhang Jian, tended to accept ideas and duties, especially the rights of society to dispose of their own, what she calls goods, thereby promoting reform of culture and the rights of the people. Popular opinion was radicalized. Only educational progress and local autonomy could save China. Rights of the people tended to be more identified with reform, And at the same time, Darwinistic principles stress the need for a state that could compete against other countries. Then, at this time, there was beginning to be also thought of provincial assemblies within China that would offer, at this point, hope that would offer a way to communicate between the state and the people. The schools became part of a new arena of local influence. In 1905, Zhang Jian created bureaus of education that in 1906 were renamed Chunxuexuo. The press gave education a lot of coverage. Merchants financed new schools founded by gentry and then started to finance their own organizations. Lower Yangtze commercial development already had done much to bring together merchant lifestyles and values. Confidence was so strong that in the General Education Association, that the General Education Association was established with Zhang Jian as president in 1906, even before he requested permission from Beijing and the provincial government of Jiangsu. Men in the new educational associations claimed semi-official functions, which initiated a division of power between monarchy at the top and local social government below. Local autonomy to them meant right to protect local interests. The Jiangsu Educational Association had a central place in promoting reform culture and rights of the people. Directors of the association promoted the study to society to study constitutional government and the Yubei Lixian Gonghui. The Chambers of Commerce studied by Zhongping Chen had a good deal in common with the Jiangsu Educational Association. They began to be established a few years sooner, but they too had contacts and interests that went beyond commerce, and they were much involved in the protests against exclusion of Chinese from America, the Jiangsu-Zhejiang Railway Movement, and the issues of constitutional reforms. The chambers also established a strong three-tiered hierarchy in which there were a few roughly equal chambers of commerce at the top, followed by secondary ones in the prefectures, and a third level one in counties or large towns. Chambers of commerce also proliferated in Zhejiang, although not to the same extent as in Jiangsu. At about the same time, gentry and merchants began a series of demonstrations against the insulting American Chinese Exclusion Act of 1904 and early agreement, and also about earlier agreements with America to build a railway from Canton to Hangzhou and England to build one between Nanjing, Shanghai, and Hangzhou. After America pulled out of Canton, the railway was reconstructed without too much trouble. However, soon thereafter, huge protests began against the Exclusion Act, particularly in Shanghai and Canton. In May 1905, the Shanghai Chamber of Commerce announced a boycott of American goods, although it was put off for 2 months to allow time for negotiation. Not surprisingly, the United States government did not back down, and boycotts began in Shanghai and Canton in late July. A large movement took place in Shanghai, after which a Chinese man named Feng Xiaowei, who had been living in the Philippines, committed suicide in front of the American consulate. The boycott was still more pronounced in Canton and some other coastal cities of Guangdong. By the end of the year, it had begun to fade, but still had much support in Canton. Moreover, there was considerable amount of support from poorer households who were willing to avoid certain products to help in the protest. There's not much information about this because I guess they didn't write themselves up for the newspapers. But you keep stumbling upon this kind of activity from, we'll say lower classes. So it did exist. The boycott ended by November in most places, but it kept being revived in Canton until the end of 1906. The largest revival there occurred in July, when the remains of the boycott martyr Feng were disinterred, carried, stopping occasionally along the way so people could tell him what a great guy he was, and arriving in Canton, where it was greeted by a large crowd of over 1,000 merchants, gentry, students, and representatives of the 72 Canton guilds. By the end of the year, the movement was essentially over and was soon replaced by more controversy over the Canton Railway. Meanwhile, the question of the Zhejiang Railway had come to the fore. It had been established in 1905 with Tang Shoujian as president and began collecting money through 1906. Meanwhile, the Jiangsu Railway had been established in that year and was running by 1907. A compromise on the loan issue had been worked out in 1908, but the question of the British loan was never fully solved. Particularly, the Zhejiang Company managed not to use the money that they were supposed to be receiving from the British. There was a major demonstration in Hangzhou in November 1907 and continuing protests for many months. Subscription bureaus had been established in several prefectures. Some small shares were sold on the streets, and there were large pledges that were never altogether fulfilled. These were made at a special meeting for that purpose. Despite the difficulties, the Zhejiang Company had raised 5 to 6 million yuan by the end of 1906. The company pushed ahead on construction, and by early 1912, it also had 10,600,000 yuan, which made it the most successful of the railways at that time. The railway construction was clearly tied up with nationalism, and railway advocates also took part in protests against expansion outside of treaty ports, usually by Japanese, but also by missionaries. The injury of a Chinese boy in a fight at a Japanese cake shop produced demonstrations in Hangzhou in 1910. However, the railway question also became mixed up with political alienation. There was a short lull after a 9-year schedule for establishing constitutional government was, this was broken when the main enemy of the railway, Sheng Shuanhui, was appointed a vice president of the Ministry of Communications. Tang memorialized, objecting and referring to public opinion. Sheng's appointment was a step toward nationalization plans that had not yet been adopted. Tang was strongly backed by the railway stockholders and managed to hold on to his position until the second petition for the National Assembly. Then he accused Sheng of corruption and was dismissed by imperial edict the next day. 4 days after that, Shiba printed an editorial entitled On the Distinction Between Centralizing Power and Tyranny. By then, in mid-1910, there was already an almost irreconcilable gap between the throne and the elite populace. Now, there are a good number of things that I would like to talk about a bit, although I have not written down about them. The first is that during the 1900s, there was a steady stream of annual floods or droughts or both in many parts of China. And by many parts of China, I mean many parts of China. One example was the Huai River, which routinely overflowed its banks, and that, of course, turned the whole basin into a vast lake. The government did not have funds needed to provide relief, and in localities such money was all too likely to be used up or stolen. In any case, families had to flee their homes with few possessions and little food. They were prey for bandits. Many starved to death. Cannibalism was rampant, and the misery was terrible. Eventually, the water would dry up, or maybe if it was a drought, you'd get some rain later. But then you had the chance to start all over again the next year. It was an extremely unhappy situation. One is struck by the number of people, students or others, who came back on their own to China, became involved in certain ways of a passing out or around anti-Manchu literature or other literature favoring revolution. But they were doing this on their own. They had not joined even an association, and they weren't members of the Tongmen Hui necessarily. They were just doing it. And there's this one guy, he was a oldish scholar who came to Shandong. He taught for a few years in schools there, old-style schools there. And then he decided he was tired of that. He was evidently very good with handwriting, so he made copies of the books for low-level students and passed them out, at the same time telling them about how the Manchus were destroying China and various other little nuggets of information. He worked in Shandong for quite a while, and then he got tired of that, so he went over to the five northeast provinces, not Manchuria, obviously. And the story is that he altogether went to about 3,000 schools doing the same thing and passing along the same anti-Manchu and other information. What a way to live. Then there was another man who, he might have been Tongmen Hui, and he was definitely in favor of revolution. He wanted to make contacts, I think, with people in Henan, but he didn't know how to do it. So he found a friend who said, well, he could introduce him to someone who could. So they took off started off on totally dark streets in the middle of the night, when this guy had no idea where he was or why, and they, you know, they did this all night, and then they finally came to where they were going, met the person that he was to be introduced to. Well, it turned out that she was a woman. She really ran the whole thing rather than her husband, but he was introduced to her, and then the story kind of ended. I assumed that he made other contacts that he was hoping to get from them. And then, of course, there was the... After the revolution had begun, there was the problem of the Manchus in all the provincial capitals. And this was sometimes okay, but it often, well, I mean, by okay, I mean they were told, okay, you can stay and we'll work it out sort of thing. In other cases, it was quite brutal. And in Nanjing, it had started out in a quite friendly fashion. But then when other forces, other revolutionary forces entered Nanjing, not having been told about what nice guys these Manchus were, they slaughtered them. And that was, and then they came back and did it again, I believe. But that did not work out well at all. And then in Shaanxi, there were, again, there was a Manchu garrison there, and it was, in the course of the revolution, the people there were bombarded and so forth. After that, they separated good-looking women from the rest of the group. Some, I believe, were shipped off eastward for revolutionary armies that were evidently lacking women. Others were kept in the capital. The rest were just told to leave. And, in that part of the country, and this was a very late fall, leaving with practically no food, not probably much in the way of clothing, didn't seem like a very happy ending. There was a great deal of this, and I got a little bit upset reading some of it, but there you go. There's the other thing that as they approached 1911, there were more armies that had at least a component of trained men and officers, so that was becoming better than it had been at the beginning of the century. It still was not altogether perfect. And there's still the military component of the provincial capitals had a big lot of Gulaohui or other secret societies filling in the cracks. And in some cases, it was mostly Gulaohui and some who had, gone to military schools and had a better education. So it wasn't really the strength of the army. In many cases, was not all that great, and this is something. I mean, I guess you would also say that in most places it was not all that great, and therefore there were not many provinces that could have run over everyone else. There were also, as they approached the end of the first decade, you had Tung Mong Hui revolutionaries, and then also constitutionalists who might be high officials, they might be low officials, they might be in the schools. And they, in some cases, got along okay. And in some places, they didn't. And I think that they became less easy to get along as the time of the revolution approached, because you were then looking at who was going to be commanding the armies and such things. So that there were places where the revolutionary military and the constitutional military were kind of trying to knock one another out. And that produced some difficulties. There was the example of Yunnan, which was invaded Guizhou and then invaded Sichuan, the southern part of Sichuan, didn't seem to want to leave Sichuan, but finally decided that they weren't getting any further, and that they didn't really want to hang out there indefinitely when they were maybe, say, not wanted. And so that, again, there was a lot of confusion. And so you sort of, after a while, began to wonder how this was seriously going to work out. The fighting around Wuchang was easier to follow because it was definite. You had definite people involved. You had three definite people that were three definite parts that were being fought over, and you knew who won. But this was not necessarily true in some of the other places. Then there is the petition movement, which was really pretty impressive, and I kept wondering how they got so many people on that third petition. But so it would seem that they went to all the schools, chambers of commerce, and any other organizations they could find, and said, sign here, which they probably all did, and they may even have collected signatures on the street. The railroad people did. I don't know, but I used to just say, oh, that's ridiculous, the numbers involved, but I've come around to the thought that that they were perhaps more accurate than I had assumed. So then this, I'm not sure who starts where after me. Are people going to start by talking about the...
I think we need to take a break here, mm-hmm. so we can move to the other room.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I can be finished at this point.
Okay, that's fine.
But I didn't know whether someone else would start out with Yon Shikai and listen.
No. This is great. Thank you very much for a rich and detailed description of the background of the 1911 revolution.